Hello and welcome to another edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. These are confusing and bewildering days for South Africa. The Constitutional Court has ordered Parliament to reverse its decision in 2023 to not form an impeachment committee to hear evidence that might lead to the impeachment of President Cyril Ramaphosa, as it was advised to do by a three-person judicial panel that Parliament itself set up to advise it. The issue is well known. In February 2020, at least $580,000 in cash was stolen from inside a sofa at Ramaphosa's wildlife ranch, Pala Pala, in Limpopo. The money, according to Ramaphosa, when the story came out in 2023, was a deposit from a Sudanese businessman who wanted to buy surplus disease-free bulls from Ramaphosa. But the cattle were never sold, and the people who stole the money were never charged. The panel which recommended Parliament hold impeachment hearings based its call that there was at least prima facie evidence of corruption and constitutional violation against Ramaphosa, it seems to me, on instinct or gut feel rather than hard evidence. In its report to Parliament, it repeatedly said it did not have access to witnesses or information. It used media reports and the accounts, sometimes contradictory, of opposition political parties and some of the actors involved. Ramaphosa took the panel report on review to the Constitutional Court in late 2023. The Constitutional Court in turn denied him access. In other words, they wouldn't listen to it. But then the ANC used its parliamentary majority at the same time to vote against adopting the panel report at all. So there was no impeachment here. That rendered, Ramaphosa believed, the panel report moot. But two parties, Julius Malema's EFF and the ATM, took the parliamentary vote not to hear impeachment to court, and last Friday they won. And this time, the ANC has no majority to brush the whole thing away. Ramaphosa's presidency, his economic reforms, the government of national unity, and the economic stability of the entire country, such as it is with an unemployment rate of 32%, are all now immediately in the balance. Former DA leader Tony Leon, himself an accomplished lawyer, is with me to examine the consequences. Tony, welcome. How does Cyril Ramaphosa survive this? Because his survival, one way or other, surely matters.
Yes, good afternoon, Peter. These are, again, the interesting times of chapter 27 that we live in or under. Yeah. I guess the options are fairly obvious, or the scenarios. One, he could resign. That certainly was the case when Parliament first was seized of this matter. But of course, his political position has actually improved since then, even if his legal position has deteriorated. So I think scenario one is very unlikely. Scenario two, at the end of a long process, would be that he's impeached by Parliament. But as you know, the arithmetic of Parliament, even with a very reduced ANC, doesn't support that. Parliament three is, or scenario three, I beg your pardon, is that the parliamentary committee, which apparently the Speaker has announced will be appointed imminently in concurrence with the judgment that was rendered on Friday, goes about its business, which will be very excruciating for the President, and maybe for the country as more evidence is led, allegations are made, and this whole matter gets re-ventilated, or some new information comes to light during that parliamentary committee. And then the final scenario seems to be, so the mainstream experts tell us the most likely, and the ANC is having a meeting this week about it, and that is that the president goes back, as it were, to the status quo ante before Parliament cast its invalid vote to stop the impeachment report being ventilated. And it simply, Ramaphosa then brings the application to review the original impeachment committee report. In other words, I'm a detribalized attorney, Peter, I always emphasize, but out of practice. I'm not sure if Ramaphosa launches legal proceedings to take the Inkobo, the parliamentary committee appointed initially by the previous speaker, into the Pala Pala impeachment possibilities. I'm not sure if he takes that on review. It stops it can't stop the Constitutional Court judgment because he can't bring us in the Constitutional Court. He has to bring us in the High Court and has to go all the way up. So I'm not sure exactly how that would affect the committee proceedings. I think as a practical matter, they would be rendered, they would be delayed. But, you know, once again, this is not ideal territory for Ramaphosa. And if you believe that his fate is to an extent coexistent with the country's well-being, because just bringing that review proceedings to actually explain in a founding affidavit why the judicial committee's finding that there was a prima facie case to be met on impeachment, why that's invalid, why that was flawed, he'll have to deal with a whole lot of the issues that he thought perhaps were buried. And they'll come to light again, and presumably the respondents will then be able to answer. So none of these are particularly good. And of course, yeah. Once again, Peter, without stating or maybe restating an obvious point, we are now not on the eve, but on the cusp, let's put it accurately, of national local government elections, which are happening in November. So, you know, this is all going to be very messy, and it's not going to be, well, you can say the ANC brand was already tarnished. It probably is. It's not going to be great for the Ramaphosa brand either.
No. So, Tony, as a detribalized lawyer, but a lawyer nonetheless, and you've taught law at Wits University, and I know you know what you're talking about. One of the reasons that he may feel more confident about taking the review that he initially put to the Constitutional Court, which they didn't allow him access for, I think is the terminology. If he were to now take it to the Western Cape High Court, and the Western Cape High Court were to find for his review, does that then render the Constitutional Court injunction to Parliament moot? In other words, does it sort of put that instruction into suspension while the review is then taken from the High Court in the Western Cape back to the Constitutional Court?
Oh, it has to go to the Supreme Court.
How does he?
I mean, it does. There's another judicial layer before you get to the Supreme Court. Okay. So it's all going to take some time. Yeah. I mean, there might be grounds of urgency, I suppose they could argue. Yeah, I simply haven't examined, and I'm not on brief to do so, what the practical implication could mean. It's pretty certain, though, whatever the first court, the puny court, the court of the first instance, in this case, the Western Cape High Court, presumably, whatever their finding is, it's doubtless that the unsuccessful party is going to appeal it anyway. So it doesn't automatically just affect. And what is the effect of appeal is it suspends the operation of a judgment. That's a normal legal principle. So, I simply don't know. Look, I am sure, I mean, he's got very expensive and very competent lawyers, Cyril Ramaphosa, and I understand, although I have this on hearsay, that they felt there were very strong grounds initially for that impeachment report to be set aside. And let's assume that is good legal advice. I have no reason to think it was anything other than good, because I know at least one of the lawyers who rendered, and he's pretty much top of his game. But that doesn't really deal with the overall problem, which is more a political problem than a legal problem, because the politics of this is something that you thought had gone away, that had ended, that had stopped, or was
completely ferocious.
Now revived.
Yeah.
So that's the politics of it. And of course, it sits on a whole lot of other things, you know, succession and people positioning themselves and saying, well, if we do this.
Absolutely.
So it's very messy. And Peter, to go to your opening remark, if I might, because I think that is perhaps of more interest to the general viewer or listener than the political fate of the president. You talked about Operation, well, you didn't Vululela, but the reform program of the government. I mean, this is not a moment at which I think, not that he's ever been that bold, that he's going to accelerate a process of economic reform or revival when he's in, let's put it in fairly neutral terms, some degree of political jeopardy.
Can I just stick with the legal thing just for a moment? We'll come to the politics because it's very interesting. So in the panel report, the three-person panel, which recommends now to Parliament that they hold an impeachment hearing, in describing its job, it says the following. I'm going to read it. I've got it open here. It says, we must make a recommendation to the Speaker. This recommendation must state, quote, whether sufficient evidence exists to show that the President committed a serious violation of the Constitution or the law, or committed a serious misconduct or suffers from inability to perform the functions of office. So what they eventually find is that there is a prima facie case for an impeachment hearing. And I was going to ask you whether a prima facie case and sufficient evidence are the same thing.
Well, usually they couple together in the sense that you've got to have sufficient evidence to have any case at all. And a prima facie case simply means on its face, without going into any detail, without having any evidentiary burden to clear. That's really what it means in practical terms. I think what they were saying, as I recall that report, and I haven't, unlike you, refreshed it in recent times, they were essentially saying, well, it appears as though on the face of it, there's some potential criminality or wrongdoing here or serious breach of the law, but we don't know, and therefore you must appoint a committee of Parliament to go and investigate the detail of it and gather the evidence. Now, what, of course, you know did happen under the previous Parliament, and the previous Speaker, is that was never acted on, and that's really the basis of the current finding. Yeah. They simply headed it off by blocking it by saying there would be no panel appointed. There would be no parliamentary panel. And now the Constitutional Court has reversed that and said the previous Parliament ruled that there was ruled on the issue of impeachment. And in order to have an impeachment process, you've got to have a parliamentary let's put it in a quasi-legal political sense. It's this panel, is going to be appointed, if it gets underway. If you take a comparison that everyone's familiar with, Peter, it's exactly the same as the impeachment processes, of which I think there have been two, against Donald Trump in the United States. In other words, what happened there was that the House of Representatives, that was their job, impeached the president. They made the impeachment finding. But they couldn't. That was just a recommendation, if you like, and it then had to be determined by the Senate whether it would be executed with a two-thirds majority. If you choose, it's not directly a parallel, but it's got sufficient. In South Africa, the parliamentary committee to be appointed this week, apparently by the Speaker from all parties, it's got the job that the House of Representatives had or has in the United States. They make a determination, and then their determination is sent to Parliament, and the United States sent to the Senate, and the Senate disposes of it, or our Parliament does, National Assembly, on a two-thirds majority. So it's a two-stage process.
Yeah. So what would Ramaphosa's lawyers, if he goes to review, which I suspect he will, and he takes it to the Western Cape High Court, what will they have to convince the court of in order for the court to uphold the review?
Well, they'd have to prove that it would be the normal grounds of review, that it's not rational, it was irrational, that the evidence before the decision makers, in this case the judicial committee or panel appointed by Parliament, did not consider the evidence properly at all, and there wasn't sufficient evidence in front of them to make the determination that they did. Now, how easy or difficult that will be to convince a court, I don't know. Because except to say that apparently that initial report is not exactly legally watertight. Apparently there are parts of it that are indeed challenging.
No, well, this is why I asked the question about, you know, is sufficient evidence the same as a prima facie case? For instance, The panel report talks about the South African Reserve Bank investigation, and it says, at the time of writing, we don't know. We do not know whether the Saab has concluded its investigation, and if so, the outcome of the investigation.
We do now know that. They didn't know that then.
Yes. Yeah. No, there's just other things that they say they don't know. We don't know what transpired in the course of the proceedings of the Parliamentary Standing Committee that heard, that that interacted with the governor. We do not know whether investigations of the SAPS into the conduct of General Rudy, who was in charge of Ramaphosa's protection, have been completed. More significantly, they say we have not been made aware of any progress that has been made by the Hawks with regards to their investigation into the allegation. So there's a lot of stuff that they don't know, yet they think they have, they decide they have sufficient evidence. And I'm sure that is partly what Ramaphosa's team would be trying to argue before the Western Cape High Court if they go to review.
Yeah, but you know, I think that's exactly what would be the grounds of review, that there's a lack of... There's no rational connection between the finding made by the panel and the evidence they did or didn't have before them. Of course, I need to say the respondent, let's say it's the EFF, or will be several respondents in this case, who joined this action, will be absolutely delighted in their replying affidavit to provide excruciating detail of all the subsequent facts which have come to light, all of which are, in a sense, make position, Ramaphosa's public position very much worse, except for that rather strange, and I recall it being strange because one didn't understand it, how the South African Reserve Bank reached the conclusion it did, given that, you know, you, me and Joe Public, Peter, if you get £100 or £500 here and you don't report it, you will be, I mean, that's a presumption why he kept it in cash under the sofa, precisely not to report it to the South African Reserve Bank. But, I'm making a supposition here. I just know if you get some paltry amount from overseas, there's an immense kind of reporting obligation on the receiver of those funds.
Absolutely.
It might be, Peter, that Ramaphosa's win in court is something of a Pyrrhic victory because it'll just further expose other evidence that will be very uncomfortable reading, you know, for the people who follow these.
As you say, I mean, he may have a good good case to put for review, but it's almost beyond the point, isn't it? Because this whole thing looks so terrible. I mean, money stuffed into a sofa, that much money, and a long chase and contact with the Namibian president to, you know, quietly hand over people that Ramaphosa's forces were looking for. It's all terrible, and it's inescapable for him. But what happens, Tony?
I thought the worst thing was that, in a sense, his best defense on the other thing, well, I advised General Ruder, whatever his name was, then the head of security, to report it. But he himself, he is the first citizen of the country. He's the apex of the constitutional project, to quote our former Chief Justice.
Yes.
He sits at the top. And he didn't think anything more was required, but somehow Mr. Chalky, his security chap, goes off in the dead of night to Namibia, where the actual thieves are, and to try and square things away on a so-called, some bizarre reason given. You know, the one, if I might misuse your question to make an observation, and you would be the author of a lot of this, Peter, because you write a lot and you're well-read and well-regarded. A lot of the criticism that Cyril Ramaphosa gets is for being over-prudent, for being over-cautious, for being bound by protocols and precedents and hesitating to move. And yet, with this parlor thing, a matter just on its face, never mind how far it goes, you've got seriously imprudent, arguably reckless actions. And just 2 weeks ago, we have another imprudent, reckless action where he goes off in a helicopter to Zimbabwe without any briefing, apparently, of his own security detail, meets with, I want to say they're dodgy characters, but apparently people who are under investigation by his own security services in South Africa, And this is all regarded as the actions of a prudent and reasonable person. That doesn't seem to square up somehow. Almost his political caution, and in these two instances, his incaution seem to be at variance with each other.
That was an astonishing visit, you know. And to come back and say, one, that he didn't know who these people accompanying Mnangagwa were, to say nothing of Mnangagwa, the president of Zimbabwe's presumption that he could introduce sort of people wanted in South Africa to the president and then film it, was quite extraordinary. But we don't know how Cyril got there. We know he took a helicopter from Merari, but how did he get to Zimbabwe? Was it the Air Force? Was it SAA? Who paid for the flight? It was an absolutely extraordinary visit. And he is careless, you know. He specifically said, after this whole pilot thing came out, and the report was and the panel report was out, he addressed an ANC conference in Limpopo and said, "I'm in the business of farming and breeding animals. I'm in the business." Then he was later on to say, "No." I'm not conducting business at Pala Pala. I'm a farm manager. He looks after that, and it's in a blind trust. He's done this right throughout his political life. He falls over himself, and you know, we end up paying for it, really, because as we're going to do now, Tony, what happens to Cyril's reform program You were saying it would, you know, it would probably slow down. Even it's already very slow, but he's going to be feeling so besieged now. He'll be loath to do almost anything.
Yeah, I think the incaution he showed with that mystery visit to Zim is going to be matched by a deep caution on moving boldly or at all on the home front, and the risk of offending, you know, his several colleagues, or many colleagues and allies, or, you know, enemies, as the case might be. So I don't think, just on the face of it, it's good news. And I was interested that, according to reports, Jordan Hill Lewis, the new DA leader, received, you know, a lot of calls from the ANC's business whisperers saying, don't take any action against Cyril. Because I think they fear precisely that whatever modest or magnificent, choose which, the reform program has been, it could, the whole thing could be jeopardized, together with the bond market, the currency market, and all the other markets that do enjoy or require stability. I mean, it probably will take time for this to start affecting the markets, because I think, you know, President Trump and the Ayatollahs are much bigger flags for the bond market than we are, than our domestic politics. But at some point, it's going to start having an effect on, in addition to the strain and the stresses that the Middle East war is having on our markets.
Yeah. The place, this whole thing has been politically charged from the beginning, and it's probably no coincidence that the person who first made the Pala Pala theft public was Arthur Fraser, a close ally of former President Jacob Zuma. He's intelligence chief and, you know, Zuma being Ramaphosa's sort of sworn enemy. The retired Chief Justice who led the original panel report, Sandile Ngcobo, is a Zuma appointee and a real favorite of the former president. And the one person in the ANC who defied the whip instruction to vote against adopting the panel report was Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma.
Dr. Zuma.
Jacob Zuma's
ex-wife.
Dr. Zuma, Jacob Zuma's former wife.
And we also have to say,
so, a lovely moment for Jacob Zuma, surely.
Well, Jacob Zuma and his possible new allies in the EFF, bear in mind, Julius Malema, in addition to being a convicted criminal, as he now is, with a jail sentence hanging over his head, actually his party is primarily responsible for the judgment rendered by the Constitutional Court, as they were for the last two significant Con Court judgments that actually revived the question of executive accountability to the legislature and made that now part of our law. And so, thanks to the EFF, ironically, that in the first instance, that this has happened. So there's no end of ironies here and, you know, strange alliances. But you might say none of these parties are necessarily friends of Cyril Ramaphosa or indeed the current ANC leadership.
Yeah. So your former party, the DA, has been quick to say it would not defend Ramaphosa if the impeachment committee recommends he be impeached. But what if the committee itself is split or if its reasoning is weak, if their judgment is regarded by the DA as not being good enough, what do they do then? You know, you have the committee recommending impeachment, but let's say by a majority, the DA, what's open to the DA? They can't be seen to be in any way saving a man who the impeachment committee, after all of this fuss, says should go.
Well, let me say, I know what Jordan Hill Lewis said on the weekend about this, and he said exactly that. We're going to follow the facts wherever they lead. We will not cover up for anyone's misconduct. And if the misconduct comes from the number one in the land, it's effectively you're saying all the more reason not to cover it up. So what the DA participates in the committee and they nominate their MPs, and if those two MPs, I suppose they'll get, on that committee come to the conclusion that the evidence suggests that there'd be an impeachment motion against the president, I think the DA in the next process to be in parliament would be obliged to follow that and to vote for it. I can't see that they can make one finding in a committee and not follow it through on the floor of parliament. That would be very inconsistent.
Would you be able to disagree with a committee finding that, you know, if you're part of the committee, or do you simply
that committee reaches its decision, whatever the decision is, on a simple majority. Mm. So let's say there are 10 members, you need 6 votes in favour of whatever the finding is, and then it goes forward. So if the DA votes in favour of an impeachment proceeding in Parliament in the committee, then that's what it will do in Parliament itself, presumably, unless there's some dramatic 11th-hour matter intervention between the parliamentary committee and parliament itself.
Yeah.
And equally, if they are outvoted, for example, if they think there's enough evidence for impeachment and 6 members of the committee think there isn't, presumably when they go to parliament, they would vote against the president in favor of impeachment in order to be both principled and consistent, I would imagine. I don't know. Look, we're quite a long way off from that point.
Well, I mean, you know, so what do you expect? Is, you know, the speaker is going to appoint a committee soon. What does it need to do? Does it need to do all the work all over again? There's so much documentation around already. What would stop them getting on with it?
There's nothing to stop them. In fact, they need to get on with it because they don't want to be they don't want to undermine or be in contempt of the Constitutional Court finding. And she's moved by her standards quite a lot of speed by making the announcement she did today. Judgment was only given on Friday. She didn't filibuster it. I imagine the committee will be set up at some point. If, in fact, as is predicted, President Ramaphosa does bring a review on the judicial panel's prima facie findings against him, what impact that will have on the committee's work, I think there'll be a lot of arguments. They can proceed anyway. They've got to wait for the end of the judgment. I suspect they will continue until they're instructed by some court not to continue.
Yeah. So the DA's positioning around this whole affair has been kind of interesting because it's ebbed and flowed, and it welcomed the Concord decision refusing to entertain Ramaphosa's initial review. And after, I think, a long investigation by the Reserve Bank into Palapala, it initially said it would challenge the bank's report, but it never did. And I think the same happened to the SARS report. Both SARS and the Reserve Bank cleared Ramaphosa of wrongdoing, but the DA kind of seems to want him to go, but doesn't want to pull the actual trigger. What should it do? Just what you've been describing, just play it straight, and there have to be political calculations involved in whatever it decides to do.
I think there are probably always political calculations. I mean, look, Peter, let's not beat around the bush here. Impeachment is a political process. It's not a, you know, it's not some divine judgment of you know, some heavenly high court that's making this. It's a political judgment in terms of a constitutional instrument that the bearer of an office is unfit to hold that office. Obviously, you can't just base it on prejudice. You've got to base it on facts, but even weighing those facts is a political judgment. So, but on the principle of everyone being accountable, the executive being answerable to Parliament, and no one is above the law, which is what the DA lead enunciated, that's what the DA is going to act on. Look, in a way, I know it's been somewhat criticised, the new leader, the DA, Jordan Hill Lewis, has really got nothing to lose. And I'm not suggesting anyone acted improperly before. I don't suggest that from own. But he, in a way, can stand above this all. Because if Ramaphosa falls, it's probably very bad for the DA in terms of its continuance in the GNU. But he politically is not affected by that. He might be improved if he does the right thing, as he seems to be doing.
Yeah.
If the DA takes a consistent and appropriate and objective line in that committee, if it brings facts to life that you'd expect a rule of law party to bring to life, you expect a party that wants institutions to be respected by their office bearers, such as present, they bring those to light, and then they act on what is brought to light. I can't see that is politically damaging. Look, I'm sure for some people, a bit like the phone calls I got during those GNU negotiations, which I was involved in 2 years ago, where the purport was, look, however bad they are, however flawed you might think it is to go into business with the ANC, however lousy the terms, do a deal under any circumstances. And there are going to be people who say, look, just this is a sideshow, because if Ramaphosa goes, then, you know, it's going to get much worse, which could happen. But sometimes, you know, you've got to actually act on your beliefs. You've got to be principled. And you haven't got to be reckless, and they shouldn't be. And you've got to live for the consequences of your actions. So I'm sure that is a consideration. And I think they will. Yeah. I don't know. Look, as someone once said, that's somebody's decision, not mine, happily.
Yeah. Just before we close, so ahead of the 2019 election, then the Musi Maimane and the federal executive chair, James Self, now sadly passed away, they toyed pretty seriously with the prospect of going into some sort of alliance with Julius Malema's EFF. One reason I supported Ramaphosa in that election. Is that prospect now completely off in the new DA, in Jordan Hill-Lewis's DA? Is it the ANC?
Well, you'd have to ask him that. I think the prospects of that happening, except for, you know, maybe they'll occasionally vote along the same lines. Well, that happens. But in terms of any alliance or tie-up or pact, it is absolutely, I think, the last option. I don't think it's an option at all, because it would be so incoherent, it would be so inconsistent, it would be such a violation, because, you know, however bad you think the ANC is in terms of the economic perspectives, EFFs by, you know, many degrees and dimensions, much, much worse. So it'll never happen.
Yeah.
Never.
So one of the things that makes me sort of, makes me slump a little ahead of all of what we're about to go through is that there's nothing to watch on television. You know, all you see now on the news programs is the Madlanga Commission or the Parliamentary Commission into Police Corruption, which will then be replaced, even if it's going ahead, it'll be replaced on all three channels all the time, every day, with the impeachment hearing. So we will have, I mean, good for the TV stations. It costs them nothing to point a camera at a room. But I find it really depressing. And you know, everybody will be grandstanding, especially ahead of a local government election. You know, who would be the best, who would preside over this best? Because it's going to be a bun fight.
Well, look, I don't know.
Glenys Breitenbach.
Well, I don't know. Well, I don't know. She presumably she's a justice spokesman, so person. So I suppose she would be on the committee. I don't know who else they'd appoint. Yeah. The DA, and I, you know, well, the ANC starts with, let's say it's a committee of 10 with four members, so they have a plurality, but they don't have a majority. The others will have two, the DA, and the others will have one each, I guess, the IFP, the EFF, and the MK. Well, the MK is actually the third largest party, and that'll probably be it. I don't know who they would choose, an ANC person. I don't know who there is in the ANC who would be a credible chair of that, you know, would be a competent chair and an objective chair. So as you say, there'll be a lot of grandstanding. This thing is not, you know, it's as much fact-finding as just political theatre. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to work that out. In a process that, although it's quasi-judicial, is inherently a political process. Impeachment is a political process done in legal form.
Okay. Tony, let's leave it there. I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope you can come back as this fantastic, momentous story unfolds. Thank you all for listening. I'll be back soon with another edition of Podcasts from the Edge, and until then, keep safe. Bye-bye.